Next is DeSimone versus Spring Point Senior Living. Council, please step forward. May we please have appearances of council?
Good morning. Bruce Clark on behalf of the Spring Point defendants. Also with me is Stephanie Feingold of Morgan Lewis and Maureen Cafferty, the general counsel of Spring Point.
Morning, Your Honor. Alex Daniel on behalf of New Jersey Civil Justice Institute.
Morning, Your Honors. Edward Fanning of the New Jersey Business and Industry Association, the New Jersey Chamber of Commerce, and the Commerce and Industry Association of New Jersey. Today is my partner.
Good morning, Your Honors. Eric Pasternak, representing Plaintiff William DeSimone in the class. And also with me is Christopher Placitella.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Clark.
Morning. Thank you for your time today. The defendants here are New Jersey nonprofit continuing care retirement communities. So the case involves contracts between the CCRCs and residents. The question before the court is focused. It's whether or not the refund provision created under the Truth in Menu Act was intended to apply only to violations of the Truth in Menu Act involving food, or whether, as the plaintiff suggests, they apply to all claims of any kind under the Consumer Fraud Act. The Truth in Menu Act simply prohibits eating establishments from making misrepresentations concerning food in their menus or in their advertising. The Truth in Menu Act is one of many supplemental statutes that are added to the Consumer Fraud Act that prohibit specific conduct and provide for specific remedies for those for that particular conduct. Now, we know, conveniently, the intended scope of the private action for a refund under the Truth in Menu Act because we know its explicit purpose and its origins. The governor and the legislature actually went back and forth in crafting the particular language that we're addressing today. When the Truth in Menu Act was first under discussion and enacted by the legislature, it didn't have a refund provision and didn't have a private action for a refund.
Let me ask you just a question about the nomenclature here, because obviously bills sometimes have names as they are going along and those names vary. What is the, not critical to the case, but what is the source of your calling the bill that was enacted, which is now part of the CFA, the Truth in Menu Act?
Well, the governor called it that in his veto statement and in Governor Byrne's press release following the signing of the act, he called it the Truth in Menu Law as well.
But it wasn't codified as that title.
No,
there are many supplements in the CFA, the act immediately following what we're calling the Truth in Menu Act, beginning at section 8-2.14, there is a short title. This act will hear and that will be known as the Refund Disclosure Act. There is no short title. It's not codified as the Truth in Menu Act.
That's absolutely right. It's not a codified name. It's what the governor calls it. And frankly, like many statutes in New Jersey and other states, many states kind of pick up the statutes from other states. Many states have Truth in Menu laws, and they're all referred to as Truth in Menu laws, irrespective of what the title is. So it's a shorthand that,
I'm not suggesting it's that important. It can be called by its. They can be called by the bill number that it had before its enactment, and it could also be referred to by its statutory place in the CFA.
Mm-hmm.
But just my question was really more, where did this Truth in Menu Act come from? And we're talking about a press release.
For New Jersey, it came from the Governor Byrne's veto statement and from his press release.
And on that point, can we agree then, since we're talking about extrinsic evidence to interpret the statute, that 56:8-2.11 does not explicitly answer the question that you posed when you began speaking, that we have to look to extrinsic evidence to interpret that question?
Well, I believe the language itself clearly limits the scope. And it does it in a couple of different ways. In 2.11, the language specifically says that any person violating the provisions of the Within Act shall be liable for a refund of monies acquired by means of any practice declared herein to be unlawful. And also in 2:8-12, it says that the private action is only for, quote, the refund of money herein provided for. When you're using the phrases within act, herein provided, declared herein, those are words of limitation.
And you're saying that's in the plain language of
the
statute.
That's the plain language.
That's not legislative history.
That's the plain language. We don't even have to look outside. But when you do look outside at the governor's veto statement and his press release, Governor Byrne identified the problem here. The legislature wanted to address misrepresentations in food establishments. Governor Byrne's concern was, look, I don't want the Attorney General's office or other agencies to have to police menus and taste food and check kitchens and all the food establishments in New Jersey. I have another idea. And he proposed as a different approach, and the way he said it is, his different approach is, i.e., a self-help remedy which would provide restitution to the defrauded customer or patron of the eating establishments. That was the problem that he saw. The solution he proposed was the exact language that we're all here to discuss what it meant. And the exact language, as I referred to, is self-referential to the Within Act. The violations declared herein to be violations of the truth and menu law, and that the refund, the private action for a refund, only applies to money herein provided, violations herein provided. So I think that the language itself, it is clearly limited. It doesn't say this act alone, doesn't say the act alone. It says the Within Act, Herein Act. In order to conclude that the refund private action under the Truth in Menu Law somehow applies to all CFA claims, you'd have to essentially ignore the language within and herein in both 2.11 and 2.12.
It could say it a bit more clearly.
Beg your pardon?
It could say it a bit more clearly. It could identify the specific provisions that those terms that you're highlighting are referencing.
No question. If they had actually cited the sections of their own act, where it's going to be codified, we wouldn't be here today.
Which is why the legislative history may prove to be quite relevant.
I'm not saying it's not. I think the legislative history nails the lid on what it means.
Is there anything in the legislative history, and I'll ask your colleague this as well, that suggests this language, the truth in menu provision, as the governor referred to it in his conditional veto, that this section is designed to apply in a broad way to all of the CFA?
Not at all. The plaintiffs make reference to the cumulative remedies provision, 2.14. Of the act. But all that does, and that uses the word this act, all that says is, look, if you have been harmed by an eating establishment violating the provision of the Truth in Menu Law, you can claim a refund under this section, but you can also claim any remedy that might already exist under statutes or common law of New Jersey. The plaintiffs kind of try to use that backwards by suggesting that because of that, they also somehow meant that the refund provision of the Truth in Menu Act somehow applies broadly to all CFA. But that really reads too much into the cumulative provision. It reads it backwards. That's not what that section actually says.
Is there anything in the Truth in Menu Act that otherwise limits the rights and remedies available under the Consumer Fraud Act itself?
No, the only limitation in the Truth in Menu language is it has a carve-out provision that says that It doesn't apply to places that sell food, but not for consumption on the premises. So the refund provision doesn't apply to that. But clearly, the CFA does. I mean, if ShopRite or Whole Foods does something that's fraudulent about their food, then the CFA would apply that. But the Truth in Menu Act would not.
Your argument is that the act, the enactment on that date, dealt with a specific issue that is referenced in the governor's statements about the budget problems and how difficult it would be to police this particular problem. It doesn't limit anybody's rights in any other section of the CFA, but it also does not expand the refund remedy beyond its parameters. Is that the essence of your argument?
You said it better than I have already. Yes, that's exactly our argument, that the refund provision is limited to violations of the Truth in Menu law having to do with food and eating establishments. Has nothing to do with the claims concerning a nonprofit continuing care retirement community contracts.
But you agree that, as the Chief Justice pointed out, that there are other supplementary statutes to the CFA that do use language that is more clear than within or herein, such as by saying, for example, to effectuate the purposes of sections 1-4 of this act, or to effectuate sections 4-15 of this amendatory and supplementary act, and that this does not do that, correct?
I would agree with that. And again, as you all know, the legislature sees more than one way to skin the cat. They make references to sections in bills and sections in other laws in many, many different ways.
But similarly, there are other supplements that refer to the CFA as a whole, as, for example, the act to which this act is a supplement.
Yes.
Or this act and the act hereby amended and supplemented. And so here they don't do that either, right?
That's absolutely right, which I think weighs in favor of the position the defendants are taking, that in the supplements, when they make reference to the act, this act and the act it is amending, the act this is amending clearly means broadly the Consumer Fraud Act. The Truth in Menu Act doesn't use language that broad. And obviously, had they been more clear, had they used
language... But in 2.13, they could have said something like, the rights, remedies, and prohibitions accorded by the provisions of this act are hereby declared to be in addition to and cumulative of any other right, remedy, or prohibition accorded by the act hereby amended and supplemented, if they were trying to say that this is supplementary to the CFA itself and not just other common law remedies and other statutes. So why does that work in favor of your interpretation?
Well, this court has interpreted that particular provision and the phrase this act as applying broadly to the Consumer Fraud Act.
And you agree with that? You think that was a holding in those cases, and that 2.13 does amend the entire CFA, but 2.11 and 2.12 do not?
I think the court had a fair reading of the cumulative remedies provision as applying more broadly. And the reason it supports the defendant's position here is the age-old rule that when the legislature uses different words in the same statute, we're supposed to all assume that they meant something different. They said the act in the cumulative remedy provision. They didn't say the act in creating the refund or creating the private right for a refund. They said the within act. We have to assume they meant something different than the entire CFA that they meant in the cumulative provisions section.
And that's language that the legislature has used elsewhere to denote the act that it is now in the process of enacting.
That's correct. Again, I would argue that those are clearly words of limitation that you would have to read them out of the statute, rendering them meaningless.
But your legislative history argument was that the entire Truth in Menu Act applies only to the Truth in Menu Act and not to the larger CFA. But now it sounds like you're saying, well, one part of it applies only to the Truth in Menu Act, but then another part of it actually does apply to the entire CFA.
No, well, my argument, and if I wasn't clear, I apologize. My argument is that the refund, the creation of the refund and the private right of the refund is the problem that Governor Byrne was addressing by proposing this language, mm-hmm. and that the legislature solved by enacting this language. So we're talking about the refund creation and the refund private right of action, not everything. So I set aside the cumulative remedy provision. That's not what, because Governor Byrne didn't propose that language. He proposed only the two sections having to do with a refund and the private right of action for a refund, and that's what I'm referring to.
Wasn't there also that legislative history statement? I think it was from one of the assembly committees that specifically says this legislation is very specific and the committee does not want to abrogate other rights, remedies, or prohibitions accorded by common law or more general statutes. So wouldn't that suggest that your position would be the entire Truth in Menu Act is getting at something that is very specific and is not abrogating or in any way affecting the larger CFA or a more general statute?
Well, I think the cumulative remedy section and the reference in the assembly sponsor statement, what they're trying to say is, look, we're not saying that if for conduct that falls within the ambit of the Truth in Menu provisions, that the only remedy you have is for a refund. We, the legislature, are not saying that. We're saying this is a remedy you have, plus you have everything else. They want to be very clear. And that was in the original enactment before Governor Byrne vetoed it.
So that would then, interpret the Cumulative Remedies Act to only apply to violations of the Truth in Menu Act and not to other CFA violations that have absolutely nothing to do with restaurants, foods, or menus.
Well, this court has already interpreted otherwise to as that language applying in to more broadly to the entire act, and I don't dispute that today.
You're referring to what with that answer?
In Limonato.
Limonato.
It specifically says that you know, in Product Liability Act
Limoletto cites the 211 and 212 specifically. Does it cite to 213?
I believe they did, but I might be misquoting. But the issue was
Sun Chemical.
Yes, the Sun Chemical case. Were they talking about the Product Liability Act and the CFA not being mutually exclusive, and they relied on the Cumulative Provision Act section of this act as describing how broadly the CFA was supposed to be.
Come back to what I thought was a friendly question from Justice Wiener after. She read for you part of the Assembly Commerce, Industry, and Professions Committee statement. There's a sentence before that says a new Section 3 was added to provide that the rights, remedies, and prohibitions accorded by the bill, the Truth in Menu provision, are in addition to and cumulative of any other right, remedy, or prohibition accorded by common law or statutes. Does that suggest that 213 applies to the Truth in Menu provisions or to the entirety of the CFA?
Tabula rasa, I would argue that was meant to apply just to the Truth in Menu Act, but I'm not challenging the court's prior interpretation of that language.
I understand that's an uncomfortable spot for you to be in.
Yeah, I mean, we are where we are in terms
That's why you're using Latin, because you're assuming that
<That's right.
laughs> we don't know what you're saying.
But if I may, there's also a structural evidence of the limitations of this. And you were asking about the other supplements to the CFA. I'll give you an example that we mentioned in our brief. There's a particular supplement that prohibits people from sending unsolicited advertisements through fax machines. I didn't know that was a problem, but the legislature addressed it. And they provided for a minimum damages of $500 each time that happens. And it refers to a violation of this act in that. But at the same time, no one would suggest that every CFA plaintiff, in addition to treble damage and attorney fees, also gets $500 per violation. It's, you don't read each of the supplements as somehow expanding to all CFA claimants.
So your view of the 213 issue is that the legislature, leaving aside the way this court may have in a different context viewed it, the legislature was concerned that the refund not be considered to be the only remedy, and that treble damages and attorney's fees and so forth could be part of the remedy under the general CFA in addition to the refund.
Absolutely.
That was the whole ballgame.
If a restaurant does something that is fraudulent in some way, you can sue them for common law fraud, you can sue them under CFA, you can sue them under this, the Truth in Menu Act laws, whatever you can think of, you can go after them for. They were concerned about limiting patrons of eating establishments and the remedies they might have. That's what they were concerned about.
But your contention is, no matter how that provision may have been viewed as having broader reach, there is nothing in either the statutory language or the legislative history that suggests that the refund remedy goes beyond the parameters of this restaurant issue that was being addressed by.
Absolutely correct. The legislative history and the plain language clearly indicate a much more limited scope of the refund and the private right of action for a refund.
And you get there by characterizing this court's statements to the contrary in Lemma, Leto, Weinberg, and Dugan as dicta and not part of the holding of those three cases, correct?
That is correct. And to address that specifically, I leave it to the court to decide what that language in Lemoleto, Weinberg, and Dugan means. You know better than I do what the court intended from that. I read it as ambiguous, because what it says, the language says, is that the Attorney General can enforce this. Also, there's a private action for a refund, and then it cites the provisions of the Truth in Menu Act, and for treble damages, and then it cites the provision for unfair trade practices of 8.2. I think the better reading of that language, the fairer reading of that language, is that what the court meant was that if you fall within the parameters of the Menu Act, you get a refund. If you fall within the parameters otherwise, you get to claim treble damages and attorney's fees as well. The trial judge interpreted that language in a more narrow way, interpreted to mean that this court was saying that a refund and treble damages are available in any private right of action under any CFA claim.
And there's no case by this court or by the appellate division awarding a refund under this provision outside of the restaurant context.
That is correct.
Because this had Dugan and the other two cases had nothing to do with that.
The issue that we're talking about today is, this is the first time it's ever been litigated before this court. And Lemonado, in Weinberg, in Dugan, this issue had nothing to do with the issues before the court. They weren't briefed. They weren't analyzed. They weren't addressed. So I would argue that in that sentence that the trial court relied on, it was unnecessary to the decision. If you remove that sentence completely, it wouldn't change the outcome of any of those cases. It is non-binding dicta. The only other way this court can take language that isn't essential to a ruling in the case and make it binding is if it declares that the language is meant to provide guidance for future conduct. And the court knows how to say that when it wants to, and it didn't say that in any of these three cases. This is not binding precedent.
Would that also be the case with the statements in Lemoleto and Sun Chemical about 2.13?
Well, I the court has specifically ruled on that. In using that language to juxtapose the CFA and the Product Liability Act, I think that that horse has left the barn.
So you're saying that it's part of the holding as to 2.13, both Lemoletto and Sun Chemical, but it's not part of the holding as to 2.11 or 2.12 in Lemoletto, Weinberg, or Dugan?
It was not part of that. That wasn't an issue at all. The truth in menu provisions weren't really an issue. It was an isolated statement, kind of a background statement made in those three cases.
It's actually made in the first case, and then just copied over in the next.
Yes, it copied without discussion.
And the way that it's made in the first case is part of a general description.
Absolutely, it was background. That talking generally about the CFA, not about anything specific to the litigation before the court.
Even more than that, Lemoletto and Sun Chemical were dealing with how the CFA supplements other laws, other statutes, other common law, not directly under or related or part of the CFA. They were totally separate statutes dealing with totally separate kinds of claims.
In those other cases, yes.
I'm just talking about Lemoletto and Sun Chemical.
Yes. That was purely a question of the scope of the CFA, whether or not it applied.
As a broad statute.
Right.
Let's
look at the entire CFA. Does it apply to this, these kind of financial services?
Which are under a totally separate set of statutes, rights, and remedies. As in Sun Chemical, they were dealing with the Product Liability Act, a totally separate statute, list of rights, and list of remedies, and also they both refer to the common law.
Absolutely. Again, the refund provision wasn't an issue. Private right for a refund wasn't an issue. Food wasn't an issue in any of those three cases. The trial court decided that was controlling dicta, and I believe that was erroneous. And the plaintiffs piggyback on that when they make an argument about legislative acquiescence. Well, you know, they're saying, well, the legislature seeing Lemoletto and the other cases, they could have done something to change it, but it wasn't a ruling in those cases. There is no statutory interpretation that the legislature acquiesced in mere dicta. If it had been a ruling, then legislative acquiescence might apply, but it just doesn't apply here. And if I can just talk a little bit more about the structural issues. The Truth in Menu Act was the first of four different supplements to the CFA that provide for a refund. It was the first to provide a refund as a remedy. The subsequent three provide a refund as well. If the refund private action applied to the CFA in general, there would never have been a need for the legislature to adopt a private refund for all these subsequent supplemental acts.
And in fact, in those subsequent enactments, nobody ever said, wait a minute, why are we even doing this? Because it's going to end up confusing because the refund applies to the whole CFA.
Right. If it was already there, they wouldn't have needed to do it.
So is it fair to state that in the legislative history and in case law, the first time this contention is being made about the entire CFA having, in addition to trouble damages and attorney's fees and costs and the other remedies that are generally available, has a refund provision, is in this case?
Yes. All of the appellate division and the trial courts that have actually looked at the legislative history, looked at the statutory language, have all ruled that the refund private right of action is limited to violation of the Truth in Menu Act. The trial courts that have gone the other way and said it applies to the entire CFA didn't do the analysis, didn't have the briefings that you have here today explaining the legislative history and the structure. And I should note also, to say that the refund provision applies to the CFA, that would be a revolutionary change in the Consumer Fraud Act. I mean, one of the fundamental precepts of the Consumer Fraud Act has always been that if you have a private right of action, you have to show an ascertainable loss caused by the violation. The refund isn't limited to an ascertainable loss. It's a refund of all monies paid, per se. If all consumer fraud claimants can now say, you have to give me back all of the money I ever paid you, that's without having to show the ascertainable loss, that's a massive change in the Consumer Fraud Act.
On that issue, tell us the approximate amount of monthly charges, either in 2009 or today.
For elder care?
Yes. For someone who lived in your client's facilities.
Well, I couldn't actually tell you because it varies depending on the unit they're in and which of the facilities they're in.
Is it hundreds of dollars?
I'm ballparking something in the neighborhood of $2,500. General Counsel is nodding yes.
Per month?
That's the monthly fee. But this lawsuit involves a partial refund of the entrance fee that's paid. But let's look at it just as an example. If years ago I was a member of a class action against Barbary, I don't know, maybe some of you were too. And my recollection is that the allegation was we were overcharged by $15. For something, maybe the giant books. And
Mr. Clark, you're dating yourself and some of us in the process.
Well,
you're actually worrying us if you're gonna argue that our bar admissions are suspect.
My recollection again, it was something like a $15 overcharge that was an issue in that particular case. If the refund provision applied to a case like that, I get back the $2,000 that I paid for Barbary, because back then my firm didn't pay for it, rather than the $15.
And you didn't argue that?
What's that?
You didn't argue that?
I didn't argue.
Against Barbary?
At the time, no. I was just a litigant, an unnamed plaintiff. And
anything else you'd like to add to your presentation?
Yes, the one other point I just wanted to make quickly is if the court decides that somehow the refund does apply broadly, we're asking that you also add as guidance an emphasis that the language of the CFA refund, it requires it limited to monies made by means of the violation of the act, not all refund of everything.
Just as your view of the remedies potentially available to this class in terms of ascertainable loss would be the difference. Well, what is your characterization of what? I'm not asking you to concede.
Well, under the Consumer Fraud Act claim,
yeah.
I think the plaintiff's theory is that the ascertainable loss as a result of an issue about the language of the refund provision means that the difference between the refund a resident got versus refund the resident thinks they should have gotten is the measure of damage, travel, and attorney's fees. What they are claiming using the truth in menu refund provision is all money ever paid by a resident. 100% of the entrance fee, 100% of all the monthly service fees charged for many years, 100% of all the other fees and charges that resident may have paid to the defendant.
So under their theory, I don't know the precise numbers, but perhaps the ascertainable loss would be $3,000 or $5,000 or maybe $10,000. I don't know the answer to that. But they would get back potentially $1 million.
Millions.
From somebody's...
Millions. I mean, the magnitude of difference is stunning.
You're just asking, you're just underscoring the language in 211. About monies acquired.
Yes.
Is the issue that you're asking the court to address, though, part of the proceeding that brings us here?
No. No, it's just my concern is going back and not being able to making sure that there is a causation requirement and make sure that everyone understands that there's a causation issue.
You want us to get ahead of the trial court on that one?
Yes.
We understand.
Thank you for your time.
You're also arguing disproportionality as well.
Absolutely.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Daniel.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The New Jersey Civil Justice Institute respectfully asks the court to reverse the trial court's decision below and hold that Section 211 of the Truth in Menus Act does not create a generally applicable refund remedy for all claims under the Consumer Fraud Act here in New Jersey. As evidenced by defendants' briefing and their oral arguments today, our state's legislature clearly intended Section 211 to apply to a very specific category of consumer frauds, namely specific acts in misnaming or otherwise misleading customers as the identity of food and restaurant menus. Now, we wish to point the court to three very narrow specific arguments as to why interpreting 211 in such an expansive way is improper. First, the cases, obviously, that plaintiff relies on in this matter, Lomelito, Weinberg, and Dugan, although they do reference Section 211 and also Section 213 as part of a general history of the Consumer Fraud Act, do not constitute binding authority on trial courts here in the state under State v. Rose. I am the poor, unfortunate soul that went down to the state library and parsed microfilms for quite some time, going through decades of briefing on these cases. Nowhere in that briefing did any of the parties argue that Section 211 in any way applied to grant the parties, the plaintiffs in those matters, a refund remedy. It was never parsed, it was never questioned, it was never addressed to this court or argued by any of the entities involved, including the amici in that case. I'm more than happy to discuss the intimate nature of the arguments raised below, but I trust that Mr. Clark's recitation of those cases is sufficient unless the court has any specific questions on that point. Suffice it to say, though, Weinberg, Lomelito, and Dugan were cases that did not involve refunds in the context of restaurant menus. Lomelito specifically addressed the question of whether or not the CFA applied to loan packing in the context of lending, and the parties' arguments in that case specifically addressed whether or not the CFA encompassed those kinds of services, and then were limited to those questions. Although one of the parties, the plaintiff, I believe, did in fact raise the topic of 213 with regard to the cumulative nature of that provision, none of the parties, amici, defendants, or plaintiff, ever addressed 211 to suggest that there was a generally applicable refund remedy. In that case, the issue was never presented or argued to the court. Similarly, in Weinberg, a case dealing with overcharges in connection with telecommunication services, the question before that court was whether or not a party had standing to maintain injunctive claims against a defendant when they were not able to present an ascertainable loss sufficient to withstand summary judgment. Again, in that case, the parties' arguments were related to anything but restaurant menus and refunds in connection with the same. No party in that case argued that the plaintiff was entitled to or wasn't entitled to a refund with respect to or under Section 211. Similarly, in Dugan, which actually did involve restaurant pricing, none of the parties argued that 211 applied to provide the refund remedy. Indeed, in that case, the plaintiff did not assert a claim under Section 211 whatsoever. And ultimately, contrary to plaintiff's suggestion for the trial court and here, those cases are not binding authority on trial courts in this state. At best, they represent dicta under the terms of State v. Rose, given that the question of 211's scope and its impact on litigants' rights to bring refund claims in New Jersey generally under the CFA were never presented or argued to the court in that case. Simply put, the court's passing references in those matters to Section 211 ultimately represent dicta. Now, in practice, if we were to take plaintiff's rather expansive view of Section 211 and played out in the real world, the result would be, as Mr. Clark explained, a massive expansion of liability for businesses and retailers in this state. I point the court to the unpublished decision of Bishop v. Richard Tina Auto Wholesalers, where exactly what Mr. Clark described played out in the trial court and was ultimately affirmed by the appellate division. In that case, which involved claims of consumer fraud with respect to a car sale, the plaintiff asserted claims under Section 211 and ultimately obtained a refund. They paid $15,000 approximately for their car. The court trebled those damages, totaling ultimately $45,000 in damages, plus attorney's fees. And it doesn't appear, based on the record of that case, that the plaintiff was ultimately required to return the vehicle. They got the best possible deal they could. They got a full refund, treble damages, attorney's fees, and they got to keep the car. As NJCJI argued in its briefing, this would ultimately result in a windfall far in excess of what the legislature intended when it adopted the treble damages provision. At the end of the day, our precedent and our statutes are clear. The purpose of the Consumer Fraud Act is, ultimately, to provide recompense in the amount of actual damages to injured plaintiffs, to punish wrongdoers through treble damages, and to attract competent counsel to cases that are of otherwise low dollar figure.
I thought that Justice Patterson had asked your friend whether the first time anyone has ever suggested the refund provision applies outside the Truth in Menu Act was in this case. And I thought that Mr. Clark had said, yes, this is the first time the argument is being made. Are you now saying that is not correct and the argument was made in Bishop versus Otto and actually the trial court agreed? And so there was a complete refund in a case that had nothing to do with a restaurant menu?
There was a complete refund in that case. It was an unpublished decision by the appellate division. So again, not binding authority on any of the courts in this state, merely persuasive. And as Mr. Clark pointed out, this is the first time the Truth in Menu Act was ever brought to this court to be directly addressed on Section 211. This court's never before determined whether or not the refund provision creates a generally applicable refund provision or remedy throughout the entire CFA. But that case in the appellate division highlights the reality that this is going on. This is not an abstraction. Courts seem to be wrestling with this issue. And the result is that plaintiffs have been able to obtain windfalls of incredible amounts.
Your suggestion is that this is an active issue in the courts on CFA provisions other than in the context of the restaurant setting that Mr. Clark talked about.
Yes. I was able to identify that case. I believe there are a handful more. Unfortunately, I don't have them in front of me right now. They were all unpublished decisions. I'm more than happy to provide additional briefing on those cases if the court so desires.
We understand the importance of the issue that's in front of us.
No more paperwork, Your Honor.
Move on to your next point.
But ultimately, our final point is that what we're dealing with the Truth in Menus Act, is a very narrowly tailored solution to a problem pointed out by our governor. As previously discussed by Justice Winter Apter, based on that assembly statement, it's very clear the legislature intended it to be a very specific remedy for a very specific problem. When we examine the nature of the motivation that the legislature had, it's clear they didn't want to spend additional resources on being the state's taste testers to ensure that food tastes good enough and is of the right quality and identification for consumers. They left that to consumers through the refund remedy. When you examine the CCRC industry, however, the state's made it very clear. They have a goal of regulating, monitoring, and getting heavily involved in the protection of our seniors. Indeed, in the preamble to that, to the CCRC Act, the state makes clear.
Sorry, CCRC?
The CCRC Act.
CCRC Act, which
it's cited in our brief,
which deals with elder care.
Yes. And it provides that the state, through the, I believe it is the Department of Community Affairs, will regulate and monitor the operations of CCRCs throughout the state, including disclosure statements and written contracts and agreements provided to customers. The state has made it its policy to become intimately involved in that process to protect our seniors. It hasn't handed over to the public at large the enforcement of those regulations. Now,
well, I don't think there's an argument to be made that the state has handed over the regulation of restaurants as a general proposition to consumers through this particular act. I think what Mr. Clark's argument was that the particular act was identified at that time. The governor was saying we don't have the resources to enforce this particular aspect, but we view in this case the consumer fraud remedy as potentially, the refund remedy as potentially deterring restaurants from acting in this way. I'm generally quoting it there. So I'm questioning why you're contrasting that to the elder care. Both are regulated as a general proposition. Restaurants are regulated and elder care is regulated as well. Isn't your better argument simply that at that moment in time, there was a definition of the remedy in that statement as applying only to restaurants?
That is true, Your Honor. But in addition to that, we have to bear in mind that the legislature has created a refund remedy in the CCRC Act that is finely tuned to address a very specific series of behaviors by CCRCs. Indeed, that provision provides a very limited refund remedy. Situations.
I'm sorry, what's the site on that?
Oh, I can pull that up for you. I believe it is NJSA 5227D-347A1-3.
And how does that help us understand the meaning of the Consumer Fraud Act?
Under that remedy, you have a very finely tuned system that allows refunds under extraordinarily limited situations related to whether or not parties were supplied with certificates of authority, whether they provided with disclosure statements, or whether there were omissions in the actual disclosure statements. And importantly, the legislature included in that a limiting provision that stated that whatever damages were ultimately assessed in the refund would be less the reasonable costs of care and lodging for residents. The legislature knows that it wants to have a specific remedy addressing a specific issue. This is how it does it. Similarly, with respect to 211, they address a specific issue. In that case, misstatements in connection with items on a restaurant menu, and it achieves it through a very narrowly tailored means. It's a refund remedy that makes sense in that context. Food once eaten can't really be returned, so we're going to give people a full refund without asking them to return it. In the circumstances of things like continuing care facilities, the legislature tailored it to make sure that ultimately the refund that would be provided would take into effect the reasonable cost of lodging and wouldn't be in excess of what was proper or fitting or just for those residents.
Constitutional issues to one side, the legislature could have applied a full refund provision to the entirety of the CFA.
Right. Yes, they could.
So the question is, what did they do here?
What they did here is, I think, evidenced by the legislative history. They ultimately addressed a narrow issue, which is restaurant menus. That's 211. It's just restaurant menus. That's all they wanted to ultimately address.
I'm struggling with your analogy to the CCRC Act, when the answer may or may not lie in the CFA itself.
Well, I think the answer does lie in the CFA. My citation in reference to the CCRC Act is to kind of juxtapose the impetus in one situation versus the impetus that drove the legislature in another. When it comes to CCRCs, the legislature felt that it was necessary to make it a budgetary priority to regulate this entity. When it comes to restaurant menu misinformation and consumer fraud, they kind of, for lack of a better term, they deputize restaurant goers to address that issue. It is regulated in other instances, but that refund provision is tailored specifically to that category of wrong.
Thank you, Counselor. Mr. Fanning.
Morning. May it please the court, Edward Fanning from McCarter and English for the amici that we represent. Plaintiffs are asking this court to rewrite the Truth in Menu Act's refund provision to apply it across all claims that could be subject to the Consumer Fraud Act. There have been a number of questions asked here today about whether The legislature could have used clearer language, for instance, in section 2.11 or 2.12. I would flip that question and ask, if the legislature truly intended to apply a refund provision through the Truth in Menu bill, which became this act, and have that refund apply to all Consumer Fraud Act claims in all categories, wouldn't they have been crystal clear on that? We submit that, in fact, the language, both in the plain language of the Truth in Menu Act and the legislative history, is crystal clear in the other direction. As I said, we've heard discussion this morning of a number of different provisions of the Truth in Menu Act. One that we've not discussed, at least in detail, is 2.9, the operative section of the Truth in Menu Act. It's only two sentences long. When you read those two sentences in that paragraph together with the title, there are 17, no fewer than 17 separate references to food, food products, and eating establishments where foods are prepared and sold. So the plain language of the Truth in Menu Act is clear. The legislative history is also clear in that this act was intended to be limited to food establishments. We've heard some discussion about Governor Burns' conditional veto of the Truth in Menu bill at that point. The first four versions of this bill did not include that refund provision. It wasn't until Governor Byrne suggested it in his conditional veto and provided language for a refund provision that the legislature adopted that recommendation verbatim. And we've mentioned the governor's press release here, but I think it's important to focus on some specific language in that press release. When Governor Byrne issued that release after signing the act, he reiterated that the refund provision applied only to the Truth in Menu Act. And I quote, as to the refund provision itself, the governor said, quote, defrauded customers are entitled to a refund if the eating establishment is found to be in violation of the act. And that's in defendant's appendix at page 70. We also added to the record on this appeal and discussed in our amicus brief a number of newspaper articles discussing statements by legislators who were both in support of the bill and some of those who were against it. All of those were in agreement, though, that this act was intended to be limited to eating establishments and food products. We have,
as a matter of statutory interpretation, and you know, we occasionally deal with statutes that are subject to a conditional veto, and often there is a revision, and the governor's concerns are addressed, sometimes precisely in the manner in which the governor states it should be, sometimes in a more expansive way. When we see that a particular provision emerges only after a conditional veto, what do principles of statutory interpretation tell us to read into that, if anything?
Good question, Your Honor. One I had not anticipated and haven't analyzed. But I think, given the context here with respect to this particular legislative history, and the fact that the governor's conditional veto was specifically tied to refunds and that the legislature then adopted that refund provision verbatim, consistent with the governor's recommendation, that shows that the legislators were in agreement that the refund provision that they then added to the bill was to be limited to the Truth in Menu Act and to remedies that were specific to violations, misrepresentations with respect to food and food products.
Do we only reach that issue if we find the plain language to be ambiguous?
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, we don't think the plain language is ambiguous. We think it's crystal clear.
But like the legislative history.
We do. I mean, it clearly reinforces the plain language of the Truth in Menu Act. And the legislative history is not at all subject to debate. I mean, it in and of itself is crystal clear as well. There's one more reason that we've advanced why this court should reject plaintiff's invitation to extend the refund provision in the Truth in Menu Act to all Consumer Fraud Act claims, and that is raising the specter of unconstitutionality. You know, if all businesses in this state, large and small, were subject to a refund for every single claim that's brought under the Consumer Fraud Act, they could be subject to grossly disproportionate and potentially unconstitutional damages.
For example, there are consumer fraud act provisions that have technical requirements for somebody who is selling, who runs a pool company. They have to have their number on a particular on the sheet that is provided to the customer. you could have a situation where someone has left off their bill that they give the cut to the customer after they build a pool for somebody, the number, and under this theory, the pool is free.
Exactly.
In addition to treble damages and attorney's fees, they get the free pool.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Wildly disproportionate damages would be in play if this court were to interpret this refund provision to apply to cases like that. The same is true for any type of business that receives recurring payments from a customer pursuant to an ongoing agreement. It could apply to, obviously, nursing care facilities. It could apply to daycare facilities, gyms, property owners who rent their property. In those situations where a business owner is receiving recurring payments from a consumer and there's a technical violation of a Consumer Fraud Act provision or a state administrative code provision subject to the Consumer Fraud Act, and the damages are reasonably small, in those types of recurring payment situations, those businesses would easily be subject to grossly disproportionate damages ratios. And the U.S. Supreme Court has addressed that issue in State Farm versus Campbell, in BMW versus Gore. The Supreme Court has declined to establish a bright line rule, but the court has said that the measure of punishment must be both reasonable and proportionate to the amount of harm that the plaintiff suffered. That's discussed in the State Farm case. In practice, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that a single-digit ratio is more in line with constitutional treatment, and has said that in practice, very few awards exceeding a single-digit ratio between punitive and compensatory damages to a significant degree will satisfy due process under the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
Counsel, do you share your colleague's reading of 2.13 regarding the cumulative rights and remedies provisions?
Your Honor, Justice Noriega, I'm not going to dispute their position on that. Frankly, if I were looking at it with fresh eyes, I would argue that that provision could easily be interpreted as being simply part of the Truth in Menu Act and not necessarily the Consumer Fraud Act at large. But we're not here to quibble with that interpretation. I understand why counsel indicates that it doesn't really matter with respect to the outcome on behalf of their client in this case. Again, if the legislature intended for this significant remedy, a refund, to apply to all Consumer Fraud Act claims, they would have said so. They didn't say so. They didn't say so in the Truth in Menu Act, and they've never said so. And frankly, if the plaintiffs want that remedy to be available under all Consumer Fraud Act claims, then they should petition the legislature. Under our separation of powers, that is where they need to make that application, not before Your Honors. For these reasons, we respectfully request that you reverse the decision of the trial court in this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Pasternak.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The legislature established with the Consumer Fraud Act a default mode of interpretation, and that is its provisions are to be applied broadly. And here, NJSA 568-2.11, the refund provision, it was cast broadly when you look at its language. And that's significant. There's no indication in the statute's language, in this court's precedents, or in the legislative history that the legislature intended to narrowly construe this provision, that it intended to deviate from the standard expressed in Lemoletto that the Consumer Fraud Act apply broadly, and that this one provision in this one instance be narrowly construed. Now, the refunds under this provision, they're intended to serve two fundamental purposes. And those are to efficiently make whole those who are aggrieved or deceived, and to make sure that those who violate the Consumer Fraud Act, that they cannot profit from consumer fraud.
I'm sorry, no, please go ahead.
What evidence do you have of that outside the food context, though? You're talking about legislative intent. You said the refunds are intended to serve two purposes. So where did the legislature say, we're not talking about someone who eats at a restaurant getting a refund. We're talking about anyone who pays any money under the CFA getting a complete refund.
Well, Your Honor, I have two responses to that. First off, I don't think it's ever actually been argued on my side that refunds are for all monies ever acquired. That's actually contrary to the text of the provision, which ties the refund of monies acquired to the means of an unlawful practice under the Act. So all of these statements about that there will be ruinous liability for corporate defendants, they don't actually jive with the language of the statute. And secondly, Your Honor, I think
you're referring to the words where it says, all monies acquired by means of any practice declared herein?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's important. That language there, it serves as a limitation on the refunds.
But I read your complaint, and your complaint states that in the case of the class plaintiff, the plaintiff, now the executor of her mother's estate, would never have allowed her mother to move in, and she would not have spent the money that she spent at the facility for all those years. Now, I read that, and it was well-pled complaint. I read that to be this person would never have been there unless if they had understood that when the time came for the refund, whether after the death or the resident moved out, their refund might be calculated not on the exact amount that they paid as the entrance fee, but on the basis of what the subsequent resident paid. So to say that there's a limiting proposition from this, I think, frankly, runs up against your complaint, which makes the allegation and actually does seek every penny that the class members ever spent on the assisted living facilities. That's what it says.
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a difference between what's pled in a complaint and what a jury ultimately finds.
But, well, fine.
What are you seeking specifically?
Are
you entitled to the refund of the monthly charges as well as the issue that brings us here?
I certainly think we can make that argument. And certainly under the...
That means you're seeking it.
Certainly under the CCRC Act, I think that actually expressly gives us that ability.
Under the CFA, are you seeking a refund of all monies paid?
We are seeking a refund of all monies paid by means of the unlawful practice.
Are you seeking a refund of all other charges beyond the entrance fee question?
No, Your Honor. I think that the refund here, I think it is tied to the entrance fees, Your Honor.
I'm not sure I understand the implications of that. Are you seeking the monthly charges?
Certainly under the CCRC Act, yes, Your Honor.
The CFA, are you seeking the monthly charges?
Under the CFA, I think it is tied to the unlawful practice in that regard, specifically to the entrance fees, Your Honor.
That means yes.
And what's important to conceive is...
Does that mean yes?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think what I think is important to understand is the refund provision, it is a floor for the remedies. I certainly think in terms of how it'll work in this case, I think the damages troubled will be larger.
So while we're on this issue, even though I think this is the last issue, the constitutional avoidance question, if someone in your position, the property had been relet at only a modest discount where hundreds of dollars are at stake under that part of the case, could someone then seek to collect tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of monthly charges accumulated over decades?
No, Your Honor, because I think there's a fundamental principle that it has to be tied to the unlawful practice, but it's also, I think,
How is that different from your case where you're seeking the monthly charges?
I think what's important to understand is that...
I'm sorry, I thought you said you are not seeking the monthly charges under the CFA.
Your Honor, I think under the CFA, how it would work, it would be tied to the unlawful practice.
That would be the entrance fees. I thought we clarified this. That means, yes, you are seeking the monthly charges because your argument is that they are tied, correct?
No, but what would delimit it is if a person also received a benefit, that
theoretical discussion, in this case, are you arguing that the monthly charges are recoverable as a refund under the CFA?
No, Your Honor. And I think when you look at the text of the statute, I think it's important to understand, as this court said in Lemoletto, that the provisions are to be applied broadly. So when you look at the refund provision, there's no language in there to repeat what Justice
Alito. So just to be clear, you're representing on behalf of your class today that the only remedy, that the only refund you would be seeking is a refund of, under the CFA, is a refund on, under of the entrance fee.
Yes, but I think that is what is tied.
Just stick with me with a yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes. So that's it. The entrance fee only, and you would be seeking what, the entrance fee to be returned?
I think that is a justifiable position. Yes.
I'm not asking about justifiable positions. I read your complaint and I read it carefully, counsel, and it's well done. And obviously a tremendous amount of work went into it to be seeking every penny ever spent on behalf of the lead plaintiff, who obviously whose circumstances are explained because of the allegation that she never would have allowed her mother to move into a facility if she had understood the actual basis for the calculation of the refund. That's what I read.
Yes, sir.
Am I missing something, or is that not said in your complaint?
No, Your Honor, but what is important to...
Is it said in your complaint?
Yes, Your Honor,
okay,
it is.
It's there. So what you're now saying is that you are not seeking the monthly fees on the basis of the CFA, even though that's what your complaint says?
No, because under the CFA specifically, and I'm not referring to the CCRC Act, that their monthly fees are not necessarily tied to the unlawful practice of the lesser of clause that we are challenging.
So why is your lead plaintiff saying, I would not have spent a penny at these people's facilities, or my mother would not have, if I had understood what the actual calculation would be? That's what is being alleged here, and therefore I am entitled to a refund of what I spent. There is a claim under the CFA for a refund of all money spent in your complaint. Is there not?
Yes, Your Honor.
There is. Okay. So that's being sought, and I understand that sometimes things happen in cases and you don't get every remedy you seek, but you are making the contention in your well-pled complaint that you are entitled to every penny ever spent, and so are all the class members, on the basis of this refund issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
There.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, I may have misunderstood your answers to my questions, because it sounded to me as though there were different answers, and I'm not suggesting any foul play on your part. What, if anything, beyond a refund of the entrance fee, are you seeking under the CFA?
Under the CFA, we are seeking the refund of the entrance fee. And in this case in particular,
anything else?
That is the ascertainable losses as well, which would be troubled, Your Honor. That's why, as we conceive it, the refund provision is a floor for what has to be provided as a remedy.
So that language leaves me confused. It's a floor, meaning there's something that can be built above it. What, if anything, in addition to the entrance fee, are you seeking?
Well, Your Honor, I think this is where the confusion here lies. In this case in particular, the entrance fee is equated to the ascertainable losses of each resident, and that would be troubled. So as it applies here, the CFA refund, it's the floor, but The ascertainable losses here, once troubled, for example, Mrs. DeSimone would be $28,620. Those are her losses specifically. They would be troubled, and I don't know that calculation.
And just to clarify, that's the difference that she claims, as I read the complaint, between what she would have paid had it been based on her fee, or what her state would have been paid, and what ultimately was paid. She was paid less.
Correct. So the way it worked, there's a 90%.
No, I understand. I understand. But go ahead.
So you're saying that's the same as under 819? Now, all of a sudden, 211 is providing you the exact same thing as 819 would provide you, correct?
In this case, I think the two do return a similar result.
So then why are you litigating whether there's a refund available under 211 if you get the exact same thing under 819?
Well, one of the reasons is, in particular here, there are class members who have not yet left the community, who have not yet had their refunds been exploited with a lesser off clause. And so those people might not necessarily have an ascertainable loss, but under Weinberg, they still are entitled to equitable relief. And this is one of the forms of equitable relief they may be entitled to.
So under, is your argument that although the ascertainable loss is the difference between what the expectation was with regard to the refund and what this particular plaintiff actually received under Section 11, you are allowed to seek the full entirety of the entrance fee that was paid? Is that?
To the extent that it hasn't already been refunded, yes, Your Honor.
It's already been refunded.
For some
individuals.
To a certain extent.
But for the other individuals who have not yet left the facility, had a determination made about with regard to how much their refund is going to be, they should be receiving the entirety of the entrance fee.
Correct, Your Honor.
So two questions. And the first, I just want to repeat to make sure that we're all on the same page. You are not seeking monthly charges under the CFA, relying on 211.
Correct, Your Honor.
Any aspect of what we'll refer to as the truth in menu provisions for now. Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
What you are seeking, though, is a full refund of the entire amount of the entrance fee. So if someone paid $700,000 and the property was relet at a very modest discount of only hundreds of dollars, would you then be entitled to the entire $700,000?
Well, yes, Your Honor, but I think the way the math would work, if the $700,000, and I'm just going to say it was already refunded to the extent of $600,000, you're not getting $600,000. You're not able to double dip and get the same amount of money twice.
Mr. Pasternak, I don't have with me the complaint, but I took a note when I was reading it. It said, plaintiffs seek on counts 1 and 2 an order, and I have it in quotes. This is my notes. Could be wrong. Requiring defendants pursuant to NJSA 56-8-211 to disgorge and make restitution to plaintiffs and members of the class by repaying all monies received or collected from plaintiffs or class members. Is that your allegation?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is that limited to the entrance fee, or should we infer that all monies received or collected is what it says, which is everything they ever paid?
Well, no, Your Honor, but this provision is an equitable remedy, and that means that
Did I correctly write down what your claim is?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it says all monies received or collected from plaintiffs or class members. That's all the money they ever paid to these facilities, is it not?
It is worded, Mr. Meyer, which could lead you to believe that, but
I'm sorry.
It is worded in a manner that can lead you to believe that. But what we
it's what it says, right?
But I think in equitable principles, we wouldn't be allowed to get a refund of monies for which we also benefited. So like the monthly fees, the reason why I don't think you would.
But this is how it would play out in the courtroom is for the future, equitable principles. This is what you're claiming in your complaint. And when you file a complaint and say this is your claim, that's what courts judge claims on. This is a motion to dismiss. So that's your claim, is it? Whether it was pie in the sky or you really privately don't, I'm not asking for what you really think of this possible claim, that's your claim in this case, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
I want to come back to constitutional avoidance for just a second. In the hypothetical that I was giving you, the delta is 10%, $70,000. So your position is that for even a modest discount in the reletting of under $1,000, say, you would be entitled to the full $70,000, that full 10% extra, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And does that present potential constitutional questions?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because the way the statute is designed is that the remedy is tied to the unlawful practice. And if the unlawful practice caused the $70,000 differential, I think the consumer is entitled to that, Your Honor.
In the chief's hypothetical, it was relet at only a few hundred dollars less, so $69,650, $350 difference. But the delta is $70,000. How is the delta $70,000 if the difference is only $350?
The difference is the ascertainable loss. This remedy, though, gives you a means of getting a refund for what was unlawfully acquired. And here, that was entrance fee.
If you paid a $700,000 entrance fee and you get back all but $350 because it was relet to the next person at only a very, very modest discount, how could you get more than the $350 as the delta? How could you get the $70,000 as the delta? What is that a calculation of?
Well, I think it depends upon what is proven that the violation caused. If the violation caused the person to pay that amount in its entirety, that could be. But if the violation was to a lesser extent, and I do think it might come down to what that differential is.
So you pay $700,000, you get back all but $350, but you can still get more than $350 as your refund because some reason.
If it's shown that the consumer wouldn't have entered into the transaction at all, yes, that could be a possibility.
And then some of that would have to be monthly fees because you already got back your whole entrance fee minus the $350, no? So you keep saying you're not requesting monthly fees, but now it sounds like you're saying maybe sometimes you are requesting monthly fees.
No, I don't think the monthly fees fit in because if the consumer receives benefits, they wouldn't be entitled to get a refund of what they received.
And they get benefits from the app. I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
Well, the entrance fee is different because it's a fee that's held in escrow. It's not
you
something...
already got back the whole fee minus $350 because it was relet at only a very small discount of $350. So what else could you possibly get aside from the $350 that you didn't get back?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, just like I understand it, you're saying that they got everything back minus $350 from what they paid?
Correct, because it was only a very small discount given to the next person who lived in that unit.
Well, then that actual amount would be the same refund amount. They wouldn't get more than ever what they paid.
What would be the same refund amount? The $350 or the?
The $350, Your Honor.
So in the chief's hypothetical of the $70,000, you didn't really mean that you're getting back $70,000.
Correct, Your Honor, if I'm understanding your hypothetical correctly.
According to the example you were given, it sounds like you were suggesting you're getting the $70,000 twice plus the $350. That's what it sounded like.
I'm never suggesting you get the $70,000 twice.
Okay.
I think, as I think it works, it is a floor. The damages can exceed the refund, but the refund really shouldn't be exceeding the damages, except in some rare case I can't conceive of.
So regardless of how it would play out in this case, what is your evidence of the legislature's intent that they wanted the refund provision to extend beyond food, menus, restaurants?
Well, I think it's important to start with first principles. As this court said in Lemoletto, you have to view the provisions of the act broadly. And when you do that, it starts from a position of, did the legislature limit the scope of the refund provision? It's not one where it's required to have language to expand it. And here, the legislature in section 1 of chapter 347, it referred to this section. And then later in the legislative history, the cumulative remedies provision was added, and that's a provision this court has found is broadly applicable to the whole of the Consumer Fraud Act.
Let's focus on 211.
And
let's talk about 211.
And then following.
And in particular, we have an argument that 211 originated after the governor's veto message. We can't read the minds of the legislature, but that was very specific to restaurants and the inability, as the governor said, in a limited budget to send people out to police restaurants. We're going to give the consumers this remedy.
Certainly, Your Honor. The legislature, the governor, did have one purpose in mind in passing the Chapter 347, and that was regarding misrepresentation about food. But
Slow down. Regarding what?
Misrepresentations about food and food products. Oh. But what's missing is any statement from the legislature, from the governor, that the remedy that they created, which was put in following sections 1 and 2 of the bill, that is limited to food and food products.
Suppose we find the language of 211 ambiguous. Mm-hmm. Then we look to the legislative history to try to understand the purpose behind the amendment. It doesn't require that we look for precise language. We're beyond that. The governor's conditional veto and his press statement seem to suggest this was about a self-help remedy for defrauded customers in a particular context. How do you get from that for the entirety of the CFA.
What's important is, yes, that was a reason for the remedy that was in their mind that animated the legislative process. But what's crucially absent is any indication that the remedy they created was to be constrained. And if you look at the language, it's very different from other provisions of the Consumer Fraud Act.
The Within Act means nothing when they said the Within Act in the actual enactment?
Well, Your Honor, the Within Act, I think it's important to look at the plain and ordinary meaning of those terms. The word within, it means inside, in, it's an adjective. As an adjective, it modifies the noun act. But what's crucial here is that in modifying the word act, as the United States Supreme Court, I think it was FTC versus AT&T, it said that adjectives, they reflect the meaning of the nouns they correspond with.
Was the enactment an act? That we're talking about the restaurant enactment, whether it had a title or not. Was the restaurant-based set of provisions an act?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. But
and then
the
they
within
said the,
act.
The within act. What did within mean?
The word within means inside. And what's crucial, what's important to understand is what is the meaning of the word act? In Section 5 of that statute, which became the cumulative remedies provision, that word act was defined as the entirety of the Consumer Fraud Act.
Where are you seeing that actual definition in 2.13 that says this applies to the entire CFA and the act as used here means the entirety of the CFA?
Well, if you look at Lemoletto and you look at Sun Chemical.
I'm not asking about a court's interpretation of the language. I'm asking where in the language does it say that the act means the entirety of the CFA?
Well, it refers to the act, but what's missing is any indication such as the provisions of the act supplementing the act.
I'm sorry, it refers to the act. You're arguing the absence of limiting language is critical, but what, in terms of the justice's question, what defines the act?
Well, in the Chapter 347 itself, there is no definition for the word act. And that's why I think it's important to look at what this court has done previously.
If the legislature wanted this to apply to the entire CFA, they could have very easily amended 8/19, correct? Which is the general damages remedy for the whole CFA.
Yes, it could have, but...
But it did not.
It did not. And what's unique about this provision, if you look at other refund provisions, you look at, for example, NJSA 56A-2.21, and that provision, which concerns retail purchases, it refers to where the sale was made. It refers to Section 5 and 6 of Public Law 1982, Chapter 29. It refers to the retail mercantile establishment and the failure.
And that followed this act?
That followed this act.
Why on earth were they bothering to add refund provisions when they had, in your view, already added a refund provision to the entire Consumer Fraud Act? Makes no sense at all.
Well, the reason actually goes back to what your questions earlier. The NJSA 56A-2.1, the refund provision we're discussing, it was cast in very general terms. It doesn't provide an easy definition for how to calculate what a refund should be. In other later added supplements to the Consumer Fraud Act, such as the retail provision, such as NJSA 56A-71, those provisions also created refunds, but they were very specific in how they operate. Section 71, for example, and I think it is important, it creates a refund for the full purchase price of used vehicles minus certain fees. And it also...
Why can't you read that simply to be that when you're dealing with food in a restaurant and the $10 or $20 or whatever your lunch cost, you get a refund for all of that $10 or $20. But when you're talking about a big ticket item, there's a more limited concept of refund because that's a lot more money involved.
Well, I think that's exactly it, Your Honor. The refund provision is cast in broad terms. And
because it applies, according to the legislative history, it appears to apply to what you just bought in a restaurant. If you get $20 back, you're not going to get $5,000 back for a lunch that is in some way violative of the restaurant provision.
So, yes, Your Honor. But that's the point. The refund provision, it doesn't result in windfalls because it's tied to what the unlawful practice is. And in terms of how the legislature wrote the statute, its legislative history, when you view it from the lens that it's supposed to be broadly applied, there is no indication in the text. The text could have said...
Well, my concern is that you're overlooking the specific legislative history that relates to 211, and I'm hoping you can respond to that. Assume the language itself in the text of the statute is ambiguous. We then look to the governor's CV. It's a traditional way of analyzing legislative history. It tells us the purpose for the amendment. How do you get around that?
Well, the reason is, yes, that is a purpose for the amendment, but it's not a limitation on the amendment.
So if legislative history is not all-encompassing and buttons down every aspect, we don't rely upon it?
Well, yes, Your Honor. The legislature was silent on whether there's a limitation on the refund provision.
Did it say anything that suggested that this would apply broadly?
It did in using broad language. It didn't use the language you see.
CV.
What?
In the CV, looking at the legislative history, is there language that suggests this particular amendment to the truth in menu provisions should apply broadly to the entire CFA?
Did no, there, say that? There is not, Your Honor. But it has it backwards, because when you have to view the Consumer Fraud Act liberally, when you have to view it as being the provisions being broadly applied, requires...
All true, but here we're trying to understand the meaning of the legislative history. And that's what I'm asking you to point us to, because it seems to be a hurdle for you, looking at the language, not looking at your fine argument, but the actual legislative history.
The legislative history, yes, Your Honor, it does focus on food and food misrepresentations, but it's silent.
It focuses on what?
Misrepresentations about food products.
Thank you.
But it's silent on any limitation on that remedy.
So your view is that its silence overrides what is specifically stated there, or makes it such that we can't really rely upon it.
Yes, Your Honor, it makes it so you can't rely upon it, because you have to view the statute liberally, you have to view it broadly applied. And if there was a statement
in the... Isn't that contrary to the statement of the Assembly Commerce, Industry, and Professions Committee that specifically says this legislation is very specific? Not this legislation is very specific, but is intended to apply broadly. It seems like broad is the opposite of specific. And here they say this is very specific.
But Your Honor, I believe that predates the refund provision. So I don't think that actually informs what the refund provision means, particularly when the cumulative remedies provision, which is also a later added provision, when that provision has been found to apply to the entirety.
It indicates that the legislature was looking at a restaurant provision. And then when you said it predates the CV, it does. But when you add to the CV that the governor is saying, I'm suggesting the following changes, I'm paraphrasing, to this act, because what it is addressing here, we can't police, and that's restaurants. So you start with the Assembly statement talking about it being specific. And then you get to the CV, which seems to have had something to do with the provision we're now talking about, which underscores the focus on restaurants. It doesn't weaken it. How do you get around that?
It's because if you look at United States versus Moscow, the U.S. Supreme Court, I think it very aptly explained that in legislative history, it doesn't have to... It need not have expressly referred to every permissible use of a statute in the legislative history. And that's what we have here. You have the legislature putting forward a use for the statute. It does not put forward any limitation on the statute. So you can infer from the plain language of the statute that it is to be broadly applied, because the legislature need not specify every single instance.
When the Assembly Committee, as Justice Wainwright mentioned, said specific, what does that mean?
Well, that was early in the process. And I think it's crucial, as this court explained in Thompson, that the legislature knows how to craft the language such that it would, quote, undoubtedly mean that, in that case, the Civil Rights Act was not limited to actions involving discrimination. And here, there is no certainty about a limitation. And given the lack of limiting language, specifically in the statute itself, in the legislative history, you have to broadly construe it, and that means it is the entirety of the Consumer Fraud Act, and that's consistent with Lomeletto, Dugan, Weinberg, and Sun Chemical.
Is there any provision, any remedy provision that applies statute-wise, Consumer Fraud Act across the board, that is not an 819? Any other? Because you're saying this one is. This one is elevated to the full umbrella of the entire statute. Can you think of any other provision, any other remedy available throughout the Consumer Fraud Act that isn't set forth in 819?
Your Honor, it's not set forth in 819, the refund provision here. But what's different about this provision and others is that every other refund provision
was specific. The answer to my question, that everything else is in a, every general remedy provision that applies to the CFA is in 819. Am I correct? I know you're the argument you're making about this one, but
well, we believe it's also, the refund provision is also broadly applicable, just as the cumulative remedies provision is broadly applicable to the entirety of the Consumer Fraud Act.
Aside from those two. So the refund provision you're arguing in this case, the cumulative remedies provision you're arguing in this case, anything else, anywhere else aside from 819 that applies throughout the CFA?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Counsel, would you like to address the import of the language in Limoletto and the following cases?
Yes, Your Honor. So in Limoletto, Weinberg, and Dugan, I think what's important is this court actually considered the language. In Weinberg, it quoted the refund provision, and it came to the observation that it is broadly applicable. And I think, importantly, the meaning of the words in the remedies provision and the cumulative remedies provision, I think, because they both use the word act, I think it has to necessarily follow that the meaning of the word act accorded to the cumulative remedy provision in Sun Chemical, which involved an explosion and an explosion suppression device, nothing about food in Limoletto, and involved.
Let me, Sun Chemical and Limoletto spoke in terms of the Consumer Fraud Act, providing remedies in addition to other statutes, not the Consumer Fraud Act, not anything in the Consumer Fraud Act, the Consumer Fraud Act as a whole, providing remedies, is in addition to all the other statutory and common law remedies available. It wasn't parsing sections and parts and remedies under sections of the Consumer Fraud Act. It was talking generally. Those two cases have no applicability to this case. This is a section of the Consumer Fraud Act that you are seeking to apply throughout the Consumer Fraud Act. The cumulative remedies provision typically applies to other remedies provided by statute or a common law in addition to the Consumer Fraud Act. Those two cases have nothing to do with this.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree on the conclusion you're drawing. The cumulative remedies provision, yes, it does make it so that the remedies provided under the Consumer Fraud Act can coexist with the remedies provided under other statutory schemes.
And that's what you had in Limoletto and Sun Chemical.
Correct. But what's crucial is in Limoletto and Sun Chemical, to reach that conclusion, this court relied upon the cumulative remedies provision, which it applied it to non-food cases and found that it was applicable. That was part of the court's holding. You can't separate that.
Shouldn't we rely on general principles of statutory construction in evaluating this? You have Chapter 347 that begins with Section 1 describing how this statute will apply to food-related issues and misrepresentations. And then it goes on through what eventually will become 2.10 to describe acts constituting misrepresentation. That becomes Section 2. And we have 2.11, which comes from Section 3 of Chapter 347, which talks about the violations. You have 212, the recovery and refund of private action, and then 213, Section 5, the last section that discusses the rights, remedies, and prohibitions accorded by the provisions of this act, meaning one view of this could be everything that just came before it, the last four sections, are hereby declared to be in addition to and cumulative of any other right remedies. Shouldn't that be the way we look at this package of this particular act when it was designed?
No, Your Honor. And the reason is that because the legislature didn't include limiting language there, it didn't refer to the provisions of this act supplementing Chapter 1960. I don't remember the numbers there. And what's different is using this general language that can be applicable to any type of remedy, when you consider that you have to liberally construe the language, while yes, there is a construction that could be limiting it to just Chapter 29, but equally, there's a construction that makes it broader. And that's what this court used in Sun Chemical. It used it in Lemoleto.
So if we have provisions in specific act sentence, but obviously, as you well know, the statute has been many, many times amended. So we should go back to those amendments, and let's say they limit a remedy. And they don't say we're only, right now, bells and whistles, we're only limiting the remedy under this particular type of consumer fraud sales practice or whatever it may be. We should then say, well, then that remedy is limited throughout the Consumer Fraud Act because they didn't specifically say we're only talking about the last five sections, as Justice Noriega mentioned. We're only talking about, it didn't say it that expressly. Therefore, we should view that limitation for whatever that context was to govern every single setting of the Consumer Fraud Act. I suspect you want to say to me, are you crazy? You can say that if you'd like.
I would never say.
You never say that. Well, you definitely want to say no, as counsel, very fine counsel for plaintiffs. You're definitely going to say, don't limit these things that are sometimes limited in specific settings. Don't limit the whole Consumer Fraud Act. That's not the legislative intent, is what you would say to me in that case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, you're relying heavily on the cumulative remedies section.
Yes, Your Honor.
Help us understand the meaning of the assembly statement, the language that was quoted earlier, which says the new Section 3, the cumulative remedies section, was added to provide rights, remedies, and prohibitions accorded by the bill. And the bill references back to the earlier language here about the truth and menu provisions, and that those rights are in addition and cumulative to other rights. Doesn't that suggest that the cumulative remedies section relates to the bill, the Truth and Menu Act?
No, Your Honor. That expresses an aim of the Cumulative Remedies Act, but because the language is structured in a way that leaves it for a broader interpretation, it's the language that controls.
You're saying the aim. So we're talking about legislative intent. Every time you say that was the goal, but the language they used is not. It is not consistent with that goal. We're already looking at legislative intent. I know your original argument is, look, the statute is very clear. There's no need to look at extrinsic materials and legislative intent. I mean, both parties are arguing that. Both parties are arguing that the language is very clear and we don't need to look at legislative intent. But we're looking at the intent. That statement is pretty clear with regard to what the legislature's intent was. I know your argument is that the final product and the language could be interpreted to mean a million different things, but we are looking at what the legislature intended. Can you say that looking at the language that the chief just read, that the legislature did not intend that for the cumulative rights and remedies section to apply to this bill? That is what that sentence says, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. But I think there's a disconnect because the language isn't structured in a way that would limit the reach of the cumulative remedies provision or the reach of
the language is ambiguous. So the language is ambiguous, and we are now looking at what the legislature intended. And that sentence makes it pretty clear that 2.13 was intended to apply to this bill.
I think, though, that's one purpose. I don't think that limits the scope of it, because that wasn't the language used.
What wasn't the language used?
There wasn't language saying this, for example, other provisions refer to a refund is available for violations of sections 5 and 6 of Chapter 1982, Public Law 1982, Chapter 29. Understood. You don't have that language here.
So what you're saying is, even though it's pretty clear that the legislature intended the rights, remedies, and prohibitions accorded by the bill are in addition to and cumulative of any other right, although it didn't, because the section does not specifically limit that to the Truth in Menu Act, that the legislature's intent here does not matter.
I think it doesn't matter because the legislature, it knows how to craft legislation to serve its ends. It did so multiple times. Chapter Public Law 19, I don't know offhand, but it's
what
done
about
so
the
with
21 different supplementary statutes that provide the director of DCA may promulgate regulations to effectuate the purposes of this act or to implement this act. If the word act, as you're saying, always applies to the entirety of the CFA and the legislature can use more limited language if it wants to, why does it have to say the same thing 21 times rather than just assuming that the director of DCA now has the power to promulgate regulations on the entirety of the CFA because we use the word this act, and this act always means the entirety of the CFA?
Well, what's crucial is the word act doesn't always mean the entirety of the CFA. You have to look at the context. If in the provision there is a reference to used cars or
so the here there's so many references to food.
But there's not a reference to food in NJSA 56A-2.11. In that
sometimes provision, this act means the CFA, and sometimes it means the specific.
Yes, you have to look at the context of the particular provision.
You shouldn't say view this act to mean the CFA in every case. We should just do it sometimes.
Yes, in this case, I think it applies broadly to the entire of the CFA. As in Lemoletto and Sun Chemical, it found the cumulative remedies provision applies to the totality of the CFA. And it's because in the context of those two provisions, there's no language that indicates it's limited to the particular bill versus the entirety of the CFA.
We understand your position. Is there anything you'd like to present in addition?
No, Your Honor. I think that very clearly encapsulates it. And I think it's because there's no clear indication, the statutory text, which the legislature knows how to draft in this court's findings previously, you have to liberally construe the CFA, you have to apply its provisions broadly, that compel a finding here that the word act as used in the refund provision is broadly applicable to the entire of the CFA, and for that reason, this motion for partial summary judgment denial of it should be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. And thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.